You are Locked On Seahawks, your daily Seattle Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Greetings, 12. This is Corbin Smith, your host for Locked On Seahawks. Joining me as always, my co-host in crime, Rob Rang. Glad to have you listening in for our Tuesday episode. Celebrating Throwback Tuesday, I'll be revisiting Seattle's Week 3 and Week 4 victories over the Cowboys and Dolphins from the 2020 season. Rob and I will also be sharing our observations from this weekend's rookie minicamp at the VMAC. NFL analyst Brian Peacock and former NFL scout Matt Williamson host Locked On's Peacock and Williamson every Monday through Friday. Brian and Matt give you the national perspective all around the league, covering the latest news and insight on every game, team, and move around the NFL. Get your picks, previews, and much more every weekday with the Peacock and Williamson podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Now for your lead story here on Locked On Seahawks. One of the biggest storylines this offseason was the apparent friction between Russell Wilson and the Seahawks. He was upset about being hit too much. He wanted more say in personnel decisions, more say in schematic decisions. Then, of course, his agent came out with four teams that he would be willing to waive his no-trade clause for. So all of these developments spawned trade rumors. Obviously, here we are now in mid-May. Nothing happened. Russell Wilson is still the quarterback of the Seahawks. And I think one of the big talking points throughout this entire saga was, if the Seahawks truly want to show they're committed beyond this season, then why not just restructure Russell Wilson's contract and push a lot of that base salary to a signing bonus? It's going to make his cap hit bigger in the future, make it more difficult to trade him, and it opens up cap space right now that the Seahawks can use to add pieces around him. But Rob, Pete Carroll was asked about this at the rookie minicamp this weekend, and he made it clear they have talked to Wilson as well as Bobby Wagner about the possibility of restructuring their contracts, but ultimately they decided they didn't want to take on those big financial risks down the road, and they opted for different strategies to combat this lowered salary cap, including voided years added to contracts.
Yeah, I think the voided years added to contract is a really big evolution of how Seattle is approaching their salary cap in the future of the franchise. Now, you know, ideally, you are able to extend Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner because they are, of course, the faces of the franchise. But I think that Seattle had so many fish to fry at this point that it made some sense to kind of focus in on what they were able to do, rather than trying to focus too much on extending Russell Wilson, who, as you just mentioned, Corbin, had demonstrated his displeasure with where the franchise was at this point. And I think that may have ruffled some feathers. And so rather than trying to allocate all of your time, all of your resources into that, I think that Seattle did a pretty remarkable job, frankly, in how they were able to piece together their roster without having much space, and still be able to bring in some quality football players. That I think that just the making the trade for Gabe Jackson, for example, bringing back Chris Carson is another example, bringing in a tight end and Gerald Everett as another one. I think all of those things are the types of moves that are going to be just as comforting to Russell Wilson as if Seattle would have just basically said, okay, we are just going to focus in on extending the quarterback and everything else be damned. I think that would have sent the wrong message to the rest of the franchise, and that would have really put Russell Wilson in a position to kind of control the organization a little bit more. And I think that, one doesn't have to look too far across the league and see another quarterback who has been able to kind of exert his power over the Green Bay Packers and see how that can be, kind of troublesome. I think in this way, it's showing the faith by the franchise that they do believe in Russell Wilson. They are trying to answer some of his concerns, but at the same time, not giving him so much power that, that by extending him even further in the future would do so.
And I think they could have explored a possible extension if he was like, hey, I want to be the highest paid quarterback in the league because Mahomes has passed him now on that ranking. You know, the Seahawks certainly could have explored something like that. But doing a simple restructure would have opened up $12 million in cap space for this year. And Russell Wilson doesn't have to sign off on that. He's still getting paid his money. It's just going to change how his signing bonus and his cap hits are allocated over the next few years. The downside of that is that $12 million that you saved is now being pushed onto the cap in 2022 and 2023, which John Schneider has never been a fan of doing. Bobby Wagner, you could have saved up to $6 million if you restructured him. But again, those cap hits are pushed onto future seasons. So you have to absorb additional money for paying those two players who already are your two highest paid players to begin with. And so as Pete Carroll was explaining, it wasn't something that they've had to do up to this point. And it's not like they've had a ton of cap space, but the Seahawks still have a little over $7 million in space right now per overthecap.com. So if they still want to be able to bring back KJ Wright, or they want to sign Richard Sherman or go out and get another veteran, they have some money available to do so. And I think he kind of left the window open. It's kind of one of those never say never type ordeals where if the right players were there later in the offseason, they could sign, maybe sign Sherman and Wright to bring both of them back. You don't have quite enough money probably right now to do that. Maybe you could do a quick restructure on a player like Russell Wilson, who you want to show, hey, you're going to be our quarterback for the long haul. We're not trading you. We're not getting rid of you. So we're going to restructure your contract so that we can go out and add some more talent around you. That is still something that I could see potentially happening, because right now there is still a lot of really good talent that's available on the free agent market. And the deeper we get into the offseason, the more enticing it's got to be to John Schneider and Pete Carroll to maybe consider bringing some of those players back in. And so they've still got some options. Those voided years have allowed them, though, to just push some really small cap hits into future seasons rather than absorbing $12 million extra on top of Russell Wilson's contract. So it was less of a risk, and it was more affordable for them to go this route with those voided years. And it allowed them to retain players like Chris Carson and Benson Mayoa that if they signed them to traditional contracts, they probably wouldn't have been able to make some of the moves that they have, adding talent around Russell Wilson. And Gabe Jackson getting an extension with a lower cap hit upon his arrival also helped. And Tyler Lockett getting an extension. So they did some more traditional methods to go with those voided years. But John Schneider and Matt Thomas deserve a ton of credit for how they've managed the salary cap with minimal space, building around their quarterback in Russell Wilson without having to use those restructured contracts as a means to make it happen. And so it has allowed them to still have some flexibility with the rest of this offseason, and they should be in pretty good shape with their salary cap moving into 2022 and 2023. When we come back in the second quarter, the Seahawks, after a one-year hiatus, had a rookie minicamp this weekend, 31 players in attendance, their three draft picks, a number of undrafted players, and some players that were on the roster previously, like Darrell Taylor, that were allowed to participate in this camp. We're going to share our observations. Rob and I both had a chance to attend sessions for this rookie minicamp. We're going to discuss what we saw at the VMAC when we return. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your sports action. Baseball season is in full swing, and you can track all the action at BetOnline. Get all the latest news, odds, and info for all your sporting needs, including Major League Baseball, the NBA, NHL, and all of the UFC MMA action. Before the next pitch, head over to BetOnline on your laptop or mobile device and check out all the great sporting news, sign-up bonuses, and contest information. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore, as this is your chance to get into the game as teams prep for their runs to the playoffs. Head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. Are you looking for a way to boost your workout game? Are you seeking a delicious protein bar without the sugar and carbs? Enter in the Built Bar, 18 amazing flavors, including nut and non-nut flavors. Some of the best ones, caramel brownie, cookies and cream, apple almond crisp, peanut butter, double chocolate. You're going to have a tough time eating just one. These bars are covered in 100% chocolate, soft, easy to chew. It's great for the health conscious guy. Lose or maintain weight while indulging in a delicious treat. Bars are low calorie, low sugar, high protein, high fiber, and they're great for a keto diet. Remember to use the promo code LOCKED15 to get 15% off your order. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, Tuesday edition. I'm your host, Corbin Smith, joined as always by Rob Rang. Last offseason, the Seahawks didn't have any offseason workouts because of the COVID-19 pandemic. That includes rookie minicamp, which is normally held annually. They did not have that last season. Rookies had to do what all the other players were doing. They had to learn playbooks virtually. They had to do virtual workouts through Zoom. And that changed this year. This past weekend, the Seahawks were able to bring in a smaller than normal, but they were able to bring in their rookie minicamp roster, their three draft picks, Dwayne Eskridge, Trey Brown, Stone Forsythe, as well as a bunch of undrafted players. And maybe the most notable player that was on the field at this minicamp, Darrell Taylor, coming back from an injury-marred 2020 season, did not play in any games for the Seahawks last year, recovering from leg surgery. I think that's where we got to start when we're talking rookie minicamp observations. I know you and I have had a chance offset to talk about this quite a bit, but I thought Darrell Taylor looked really explosive, as much as you're going to be able to tell in minicamp workouts, obviously not training camp practices, not near as rigorous, no contact, things like that, but he looked healthy. He looked explosive, was moving really well. He looked like the fluid athlete that we know him to be before this injury. Maybe the only concern that I have, and it's still early enough in the offseason this can be addressed, but he told reporters that he weighs 245 pounds. He's going to have to get back up to 255, 260. At least that's my opinion, in order to be effective here in the NFL.
You know, I don't know that I agree with you on that, Corb. I mean, I think that he certainly needs to add a little bit of weight. But Bruce Irvin was very effective in a similar role at 251. That's very similar to what Cliff Avril was in playing that down defensive end Leo position, right around 250 at 255. Certainly, that is important weight. If you're 240 pounds, you're going to get moved around the point of attack. But at the same time, I think that that Darrell Taylor has the ability to be able to do that. His weight has bounced up and down throughout his time in the NFL and previously at the University of Tennessee. So I'm not real concerned about the weight at this point. And I would absolutely agree with you, on the other hand, about what Taylor looked like on the field. Now, it's important if we're talking about a guy who might be playing a lot of linebacker. Obviously, tackling is the most critical part of that. And you aren't able to do that in a mini camp, as you mentioned. But just the fluidity and changing directions that he showed, the initial burst up field, the bend that he possesses, and being able to kind of dip underneath the reach of offensive linemen and be able to quickly corner and be able to close downhill to get pressure on the quarterback, I thought was very impressive. I was really interested in how he was going to be able to drop back in space as a linebacker. Now, again, this is something he did at Tennessee previously, but just seeing how comfortable he was in doing so, and just watching him against some of the other linebackers in Seattle's roster over the weekend, he just felt like in two or three strides, he was able to cover as much ground as some of the other linebackers were covering in five or six strides. It was just effortless. It was so fluid, and you could just really see his length and his just natural athletic ability. Again, I think that there's very similar traits here as Bruce Irvin, and I think that's one of the reasons why Seattle feels so confident that they don't have to bring back KJ Wright unless they want to, because they already have a strong side linebacker waiting in the wings in Darrell Taylor.
And I asked Pete Carroll about this after Saturday's practice, because the Seahawks played a lot of bare fronts last season, and that involves having a nose tackle that's covered head up on the center. You've got two 3-tech defensive tackles covering the B gaps, and then you have two overhanging defenders that are in 9-tech that are wide. Stand up, defensive ends, linebackers. Really, in that particular scheme, it's like having two outside linebackers, hybrid, like 3-4 edge rushers. And they have their Leo and their Sam linebacker at those two spots. KJ Wright has never been known as much of a pass rusher. Now, part of it, they've not used him in that capacity. He did have a couple of sacks last year. I felt like as the season progressed, he became more involved in blitz packages and he was able to turn up the heat on quarterbacks a little bit, but that is not a strong point in his game. So I asked Pete, straightforward, you know, are you looking for somebody that really can cut his teeth as a pass rusher at that position? And he made it clear that that's something that they're trying to emphasize here. And so I think that they know Daryl Taylor. You look at the skill set that he brings to the table. You mentioned the athletic fluidity. He's going to be able to drop back into coverage. And he was doing a nice job. Again, it was on air for the most part this weekend. So there's caveats to this. He was not covering necessarily receivers all the time. It's just not a normal NFL training camp practice by any means. But you could see that athleticism. You can see how well he moves in space. You could see the burst off the line of scrimmage. To me, that is still the best thing that he brings to your defense, is his ability to pin his ears back and get after the quarterback. And so if they're going to be playing a lot of those bare fronts, which I believe with the personnel that they've got, they are going to continue doing that a lot. Having a player like Daryl Taylor is going to give them even more flexibility as long as he's able to hold up against the run and set the edge, because that's what KJ Wright did so darn well at that Sam linebacker spot last year. And so that's going to be the big question mark for me. And then maybe that's why I'm a little more concerned than you are about the fact that he's pretty lean in the lower body, especially looks a little light to me. I'd like to see him get another 5 to 10 pounds on his body before training camp, so that he's able to hold up a little bit better at the point of attack, because he's going to be playing in the trenches still a lot, even if he's playing that Sam linebacker spot. But he was double dipping, getting some work as an edge rusher, working on his drops and a linebacker. And so they are going to continue to search for ways to get him on the field. That was easily the most exciting thing to me. I'm going to mention this. Offensive linemen, you can't really evaluate this time of year other than just looking at them with their helmets on and just seeing what they look like physically. You can't really evaluate offensive linemen because they're not blocking anybody. But my goodness, Stone Forsythe and Greg Island. You want to talk about two guys that don't look like they necessarily belong on the field with everybody else? It feels like the Seahawks are building a basketball team on their offensive line. 2 6-foot-8 guys that just made all the other linemen on the field look like dwarves.
They really did. You know, I think Island is, you know, appropriately named, even though his name is spelled differently. I mean, he just looks like a piece of granite out there as far as just his overwhelming size. And speaking of Grant, Stone Forsythe, another appropriately named man. I mean, he just, there's not many guys out there who are 320 pounds that have a six pack, but I think Stone Forsythe might be one of them. And again, I would kind of beg to differ with you a little bit. I think that, you know, you can evaluate the offensive lineman a little bit. I mean, certainly you cannot, again, in these kind of practices, you're not going to have the physicality, you know, but you can see foot speed. You can see balance and things like that. And I was really impressed by Forsythe in that way. And that kind of marries with what I saw on tape while he was at Florida. He is a better pass protector. And so I expected him to be impressive in that regard. I thought it was interesting, though, that he played, I believe, exclusively at left tackle for Seattle on Saturday's practice. Whereas with Island, he was moved around a little bit. I don't know that I saw him at right tackle, but I know I did see him at left tackle as well as left guard. And for given his size, I think that that's going to be interesting, because he, like Forsythe, has struggled a little bit with pad level and leverage. And so if you're going to move him inside a guard, then he's going to have to be that much quicker. And I thought that he did a pretty nice job at that at times. But there also were some times where Seattle's defensive tackles were able to get inside and kind of wreak some havoc. So that's going to be a huge transition for him. But kind of just going off of what was the most exciting things that I saw on the field. To me, the most exciting thing, there was no question about it, was Dwayne Eskridge's ability just to create separation. I mean, he was open on virtually every single snap, Corbin, and, you know, broke free for a long touchdown, you know, while being guarded by Seattle's second draft pick this year, Trey Brown, of course. And so you're going up against quality competition, two guys that faced off against each other several times during the Senior Bowl practices, as we discussed on yesterday's show with Senior Bowl executive Jim Nagy. And to me, that was the most exciting part of it, is that in terms of just pure athletic ability, there were two guys that absolutely just took my breath away. Daryl Taylor, as we talked about before, and definitely Dwayne Eskridge, and what the possibilities that he might be able to provide Seattle on offense, especially when they have a quarterback like Russell Wilson throwing the ball, rather than, you know, what they had in Danny Etling throwing the ball last weekend.
Yeah, Eskridge versus Brown was the marquee attraction at this rookie minicamp, because you can get more evaluating receivers and corners at these type of practices than offensive linemen. Obviously, you're right about the movement skills. You can see that with Stone Forsythe. But me as an evaluator, what I'm really looking forward to is seeing how does that movement translate to moving guys off the line of scrimmage and being able to carry out their zone blocking schemes and stuff like that. When talking about receivers versus corners, though, you can see a much closer to normal practice at those position groups. Now, the corners can't be as physical. The receivers can't be quite as physical at the line of scrimmage because there are contact limitations. But you can still have these receivers running routes. The corners can still be going against them in coverage. And just seeing the way those two compete against one another, it's going to be fun every single day for those two to continue making each other better. And Trey Brown learned the hard way that Dwayne Eskridge has legitimate 4.3 speed because he got torched a few times in Saturday's practice. And I asked him about it after practice, and he said, hey, that's going to happen sometimes. He got drafted too. You know, you're going against another really good player that was a Senior Bowl invite. And those two played against each other a bunch in Mobile. So you've got a nice little budding rivalry there between teammates, guys that have gone against each other in the pre-draft process. Now they're going to get to play against each other in practice. And so that was fun. One of the receivers that really jumped out to me, we're talking about speed and quickness, Connor Weddington, the undrafted rookie out of Stanford. I was impressed with what I saw from him this weekend, and he took advantage of his opportunities. Kay Johnson and Tamorian Terry were injured and didn't practice, at least on Saturday. And so Connor Weddington was able to take advantage of the fact he got more reps, and he was getting open. He was showing soft hands, catching the ball away from his body, turning up field, good burst and acceleration. You know, he's got a running back background as well as kick and punt return. So where he can really give himself a fighting chance to make this football team in August is in special teams. But he was better than I expected as far as running routes. And he might be a player that has sleeper written all over him as we get into training camp in the preseason.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, as we talked about with Dwayne Eskridge, to me was the star attraction. He also had a significant drop, and I did not see that from Weddington. And I didn't see every single route that he ran, but of the ones that I did see, Weddington was able to get consistent separation. He caught the ball well with his hands and was able to make people miss once he secured the football. And so with a kind of a fluid transition there. So considering the fact that he was better known for his special teams prowess and versatility at Stanford than he was in actually scoring touchdowns, he showed a little bit more make you miss and yardage after the catch kind of possibilities than I anticipated. So I would agree. I thought that he had an impressive debut. Another player that really intrigued me is a tight end, Nick Gagamus, 6'5", 253 pounder out of tiny college, St. Thomas. And this is an older prospect. It's one who has a little bit of tie to Pete Carroll because as you told me, Pete Carroll had apparently coached his father way back in the days. But, you know, this isn't just bloodlines or you know, any kind of a relationship there is why Gagamus is getting his opportunity. You see a guy who is a really intriguing athlete, and I like some of the talent that Seattle has at tight end, including Tyler Mabry, who made this team a year ago, or at least was on their practice squad a year ago as an undrafted free agent at Tennessee. But Gagamus is just a different level of athlete here. Now, he did not take full advantage of the few opportunities he had. There were a couple of slightly overthrown balls by Danny Etling, including one that got picked off by the Arizona State safety, Ashari Croswell, but Gagamus just moves differently than most guys. Are 6'5", 250 pounds, got really long arms, and so he is a guy that is really intriguing. We're talking about, you know, some of these players that are kind of have sleeper written all over them. Gagamus is a name that Seahawks fans should be paying attention to.
It's going to be all about staying healthy for him. He was unable to do that at St. Thomas. I believe he had one catch in his college career. So we're talking about a guy that is truly a size and traits-based prospect that's worth taking a look at. And you could see the athleticism at his size on the field. He's going to have to make better do of his opportunities than what he did this weekend. But certainly a player that I'm going to have close eyes on once we get into further off-season workouts and eventually training camp in August. When we return in the third quarter, I'm going to be riding solo. Rob's going to check out for the third quarter. I'm going to be revisiting week 3 and week 4 from Seattle's 2020 season victories over the Cowboys and the Dolphins here on Throwback Tuesday. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. With the ever-increasing numbers of makes and models, it is now impossible to stock all the parts you need in a traditional chain storefront. Why endure often pointless or seemingly intimidating questioning and wait while the counterman orders the parts on his computer, choosing the only brand his warehouse happens to carry? You have computers with access to rockauto.com and in your pocket. RockAuto.com is a family business serving auto parts customers online for 20 years. Go to RockAuto.com to shop for auto and body parts from hundreds of manufacturers. Best of all, prices at RockAuto.com are always reliably low, and the same for professionals and do-it-yourselfers. Why spend up to twice as much for the same parts? Go to RockAuto.com right now and see all the parts available for your car and truck. Write Locked On in their How Did You Hear About Us box so they know we sent you. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need, rockauto.com. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, Tuesday edition. I'm your host, Corbin Smith. Last week, we kicked off our annual season in retrospect series, looking back at games from the 2020 season. Continuing Seattle's red-hot 5-0 start, I'm going to revisit the team's Week 3 and Week 4 victories over Dallas and Miami. Let's start in Week 3, the Seahawks returning home, second straight week. Week before that, they beat the New England Patriots in primetime, held on with a last-second tackle by LJ Collier against Cam Newton at the goal line, and they followed up with another crazy game at home. You could make an argument this might have been the most exciting game the Seahawks played all season. It was a back-and-forth track meet for the last three quarters because it kind of started slow a little bit for the Seahawks and the Cowboys, both offenses. But once they started heating up, the defense had absolutely no chance. And you could especially say that for the Seahawks. I really felt like this was the low point for the Seahawks from a defensive struggle standpoint. They had some other really bad games after week three, but this was probably the one game that stood out to me as the worst performance on that side of the football all year long. Dak Prescott carved up the secondary, 472 passing yards, three touchdowns. He did throw a couple of interceptions, and he lost a fumble on a strip sack by Jaren Reed. So there were three crucial turnovers created by Seattle's defense. It's something they did throughout the first half of the season to mitigate the huge chunks of yardage that they were giving up each week. But you look at some of the players that did damage in this game. Obviously, Dallas with Amari Cooper and rookie CeeDee Lamb and Michael Gallup. They've got a number of talented receivers, and yet it was Cedric Wilson. Yes, Cedric Wilson that ended up burning them in the second half. Gallup had a long touchdown working against Shaquille Griffin, but Wilson had two 40-plus yard touchdown catches in this game, both of them having big chunks of yardage after the catch, and he just exploded past the Seahawks defenders. The secondary simply could not stop anyone at this point. Then things just got worse. Jamal Adams gets hurt early in the fourth quarter, injures his groin. He ends up missing the next four games, and they finally will get him back later in the year. But this secondary already was dealing with some issues injury-wise. Quentin Dunbar was out for this game, eventually ended up going on injured reserve with a knee issue that was giving him problems all season long. And Adams being out, that certainly put the secondary in a difficult spot. But you got to give credit to Ryan Neal, who replaced him in this game. First time that he had gotten extensive action playing defense in the NFL, and all he did was have the game-clinching interception in the end zone to close things out. They needed every one of Russell Wilson's five touchdowns. Really, he should have had six in this game because this was the game where DK Metcalf infamously was showboating as he approached the goal line and ended up having the ball stripped out of his hands right before he got there. That really almost ended up being a killer sequence of events in this game. When you consider Seattle won by just 7 points and Dallas had an opportunity to tie the game late, they marched deep into Seahawks territory before Prescott chucked it in the end zone and Ryan Neal pulled it down for the game-ending interception. The Seahawks, up to that point, had not proven that they could get a stop. Dallas was doing whatever they wanted to do offensively. And so those 7 points that were lost on that play by Metcalf loomed large throughout the entirety of the second half. And really, it was a play that he will forever learn from, and hopefully all the Seahawks players will, that until you're in the end zone, Nothing is guaranteed, and you can't afford to get off your guard like that. So I know Metcalf's after the game was something he certainly learned from, never would happen again. They ended up overcoming that lost touchdown by winning by 7 points. You could easily say that Russell Wilson was the player of the game here, but we've named Wilson the player of the game in the first 2 weeks. Why not one of the receivers that has been catching passes from him? Tyler Lockett with 9 receptions for 100 yards and 3 touchdowns in this game. The Cowboys had no answer for him. He beat him vertically for a 43-yard touchdown. That was Seattle's first touchdown of the game. And then later, he had a couple touchdowns inside the red zone where he was able to get open in tight spaces. One of the best receivers in the NFL at doing that. He's really good at creating separation with his quickness and his route running savvy. So the Cowboys didn't really have an answer for him either. So this really was just a game where two teams, the defenses, particularly the secondaries, just were really struggling to slow down anybody. And to me, the stat of the game, it was 3 turnovers to 1 in favor of the Seahawks. But really, you could call it 4-1 because the Seahawks did get a safety in the first half, and that ended up being a big deal as well. Brian Monet got into the backfield and knocked down Ezekiel Elliott before he could get out of the end zone. And they also had 2 interceptions, including Neal's game ender. And they also had the forced fumble by Reed. You take out the 1 fumble by DK Metcalf, which may have been the most costly of all of these turnovers because he was literally inches away from scoring a touchdown. You take that out of the equation here, though. Dallas, the big reason that they were not able to win this game is because they had too many crucial turnovers. And you got to give the Seahawks defense credit. Again, that's what they did throughout the first part of the season to overcome the fact that teams were moving the ball very easily up and down the field. They were coming up with clutch stops when they needed them, and that allowed them to exit this game with a 3-0 record. Now, the following week, traveling cross-country, this is the toughest road trip, aside from if they go to London or, you know, Mexico City, the toughest road trip the Seahawks can make, the longest one that they can make, is going to Miami, and they lost there in 2012. So this has not been typically a trip that's been a good one for the Seahawks. And going there early in the season, you have to deal with a sweltering heat. And ironically, the Seahawks offense cooled down a bit in this game. They still were able to put up 31 points. But Russell Wilson, even with 360 passing yards, he threw an ugly red zone interception that cost the team some points. And it kept Miami in the game. He did get a late touchdown to David Moore in a play where he improvised, got out of the pocket, and that ended up sealing the deal for Seattle. And defensively, it was not a dominant performance by any means. This game was not near as exciting as some of the earlier games in the season, even though the Seahawks only won by 8 points. Some garbage points late by the Dolphins made it a 1-possession game. But this was not a game that ever really felt in doubt. Ryan Fitzpatrick threw for 315 yards, but a lot of that yardage was empty yardage. He had no touchdowns. He threw a pair of interceptions. Ryan Neal, first career start, got a pick on the opening possession of the game. And towards the end of regulation, Shaquille Griffin got an interception. The Seahawks ended up capitalizing off of that and getting points. So the turnover margin, again, worked in Seattle's favor. That's always especially beneficial when you are playing on the road. To me, the player of the game in this one, though, it's got to be Chris Carson out of the backfield, because in week 3, that Cowboys game, this became a national storyline. Tristan Hill, the Cowboys defensive tackle, after tackling Chris Carson, he tweaked his knee in a way that didn't need to be done. And it was a very dirty play. And Carson ended up leaving the field. It looked like it was a severe knee injury. I actually wondered in the press box if that was the last time we would see Chris Carson in a Seahawks uniform, because he was scheduled to become a free agent. I thought that might be a season-ending injury, which would be unfortunate because he has had one already in his career, had a fractured ankle his rookie season that limited in just 4 games. He's had a couple other injuries. So I thought that might be the last time we see Chris Carson, and luckily, that was not the case, and he was back the next week, made a miraculous recovery, and he got knocked out of this game against Miami briefly, too. He took a hard shot and fumbled, and I wondered if we'd see him back the rest of the game, and they tested him for a concussion. He passed protocol, came back in, and continued to run hard. He finished with 16 carries for 80 yards and a pair of touchdowns. That's a good game any day of the year. But especially considering what he was coming back from, how nasty that knee injury looked, for him to play 1 week later and not only play, but play at the level he did and give the Dolphins defense issues the way that he did. He caught a few passes out of the backfield as well. So this was one heck of a performance. And I remember Pete Carroll just lauding his toughness after the game, his willingness to put his body back on the line just 1 week after he was knocked out of the game against the Cowboys, what looked like an injury that was going to at least cost him some time. I thought for sure that he would end up missing a handful of games minimum after that nasty play by Tristan Hill. But luckily for Seattle, he was able to come back in quick order and had one of his best games of the season to help them move to 4-0. The stat of the game for me, this is one of the rare instances where the Seahawks had zero penalties. And you want to talk about a way to win on the road? Don't make mistakes. Don't have self-inflicting wounds. Penalties can be a huge equalizer in these type of games when you're playing in a tough road environment. And the Seahawks were able to stay out of the penalty column. They had the one costly turnover in the red zone. But otherwise, this is a pretty clean game for the Seahawks. And that's why it never felt in doubt. And they were able to continue their undefeated season through week 4. As always, you can follow me on Twitter at Corbin Smith NFL. You can follow Rob at Rob Rang. Check out Locked On Seahawks on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and the all-new Audacy app. That's AUDACY. Coming up on our Wednesday show, we're going to continue our post-draft depth chart review, going back to the offensive side of the football, looking at the Seahawks receiver room. A lot of intriguing names battling for a handful of spots in a very competitive position group. Thanks for listening in. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. Go Hawks.